Talk given Sunday, 15th December, 1974. Music is the marriage of heaven and earth. Let us consider for a few moments the nature of music. It is a succession of sounds which satisfy our aesthetic sense. The parts of music, the different voices, if you like to use that term, move into positions of discord, and then they move out into positions of concord, and again into discord, and again into concord, and so on, until the whole work is completed. And the overall effect is harmony. This is what we must remember very, very carefully, that the overall effect is harmony. And harmony transcends the duals, discord and concord, transcends them not by rejecting any one of them, but by utilizing them in such a manner and making the movement proceed in such a manner that the overall effect is completely satisfying. It is inspiring, uplifting. And it expresses something which is not just oneself. It goes right beyond self-expression. It is the embodiment of beauty in a transcendent sense. Transcendence itself is manifested then through the work of the composer. Assuming, of course, that he is a really great composer and has produced a work of true beauty. Now we must look into this when we are alone by ourselves very carefully. Nothing is rejected. There is no partisan activity, so to say, in favor of the concord against the discord, or in favor of the discord against the concord. And the person, as a separate personality, is wholly transcended in the creation of an immortal work of art. This transcending of the self is of fundamental importance. Your music will express the things of our ordinary life: joy, sorrow, horror, terror maybe, whatever it expresses. But it does not express it, if it is truly great music, it does not express it at its own level. At the level of mere sorrow, for example, because then it will just descend into self-pitying misery, which does not bring healing to the listener, nor to the composer. It does not express mere joie de vivre, if it is very great music, but it expresses the joy of life, the zest of life, in its transcendence. Now, how does the composer do this? There is no musical technique for it. If his genius stops short at mere music, he will produce wonderful sounds. But they won't belong to just that extraordinary realm, which is music, which utterly defies analysis, description, and so forth. We just say, this is music. How does the composer do it? A great composer presents his living experience. Again, not merely at the level of the experience, which will be at the level of one and or other of duals, opposites. Rage and tenderness, peace and storm, and so forth. He takes his experience into his own innermost being. He doesn't do this consciously because he's gifted with the genius to do it. He takes it into his own innermost being. And in that condition, a transmutation of each of the duals takes place. And because the good God has gifted him that way, he can express it in sound. You can take numberless examples out of the great music of the world and see this. It is the transcending that is important. Because in the transcending, one is wholly one's real being. The human. What is this thing we call a discord? Let us apply this idea of music as the marriage of heaven and earth to our own lives. How does the discord arise? The stream of life gets entangled upon itself. How does it get entangled upon itself? Through our own ignorance, our own desires, our own demands upon life, and the attempt to dictate to it what it ought to be, our particular likes and dislikes, and our inveterate habit of taking sides with what we like against what we dislike, or taking sides with what we think ought to be done and should be the situation, as against a situation which is something which we have not foreseen or calculated for. So the stream of life turns in upon itself and gets entangled. And it produces a discord in our being. And what do we do normally with the discord? We do not, like your composer of genius, resolve that discord by making these same streams which flowed into a position of discord continue to move in such a manner that they move into a position of concord. We set ourselves up against discord. We want to get rid of it. We don't like it. But there are millions of things in the universe we don't like. We can't get rid of any one of them, and certainly not of the universe. And the things in the universe and people in other people in the world might dislike us. And if the same outlook is applied, they would want to get rid of us. Wars, murders, there you are. And so it goes on. We do not discover how to let the stream of life flow in such a manner that the different elements composing it moves out of positions of discord into positions of concord and so on, making an overall harmony. Take the discord into one's own being, like the composer does with his experience, his emotion. Take it completely into one's own being. Let it be there. Watch it. Nurture it. Understand it. And in the watching, through the understanding, the power for the resolution of ill into good operates. And that which is ill turns into good. We can never destroy what we call ill. We neglect it, ignore it, run away from it, avert our gaze from it at our own peril. That is always the case. Or if we are egotistic and violent natured, we turn round and face it like a raging beast of prey. That's no good either. Because that way doesn't come healing. That way comes the attempt to gobble up. And when the gobbling goes to the degree of just that little bit of an extra gobble, then oneself bursts inside, breaks down under it. No, not the way of destructive conflict, but the way of understanding. And the way of understanding means love in its supreme sense. The love which makes no demands, which is unpossessing, which lives by letting live, which is infinitely patient, forbearing, which doesn't lay down the law anywhere, which is always prepared to let go, not to hold, to have, to grasp. Hold, have, grasp, and see what happens. The stream of life turns round upon yourself and makes you ill and unhappy, miserable, leads to decrepitude, to the spoiling of the beauty of creative energy, which is embodied as you yourself. This love is not an emotion. It is not sentimental. It is the reality allowed to reign supreme in one's life. And that which obstructs this reality and creates discord and makes the streams of life turn round upon us is our own conceptions, our own ideas, our own inner fixations of what love ought to be. And because of that, there is no understanding. There is no coming together. no interplay of unique human being with a unique human being. See, where there is infinite resilience, there is indestructibility. How will you destroy or hurt or even hurt that which is infinitely resilient? Have you ever drawn your sword and slashed the air? And have you ever heard that air scream with pain? Perhaps you have heard it whistle in derision at your efforts. But nothing more than that. And if it is outer space, where there is no air, there is complete silence. And there is the futility of the unintelligent act of being the antagonist of the emptiness, the void, which is total resilience, which is total power, invincibility, which is the eternity of life beyond any possibility of our comprehension by the brain. Now, this discord in our lives, this stony concretization of that which should be throbbing like a vigorous heart with love, with understanding. Understanding is of the heart and the head combined. The marriage of the heart and the head produces understanding. When one takes something right into oneself, that takes the discord right into oneself, absorbs it and allows it to solve itself, to become resolved, then heaven has been in action, and the marriage of heaven and earth has taken place. All this is of fundamental importance because the sorrow, the misery, the troubles, the disasters which overtake the human race are our misdoing within ourselves, our darkness which gets expressed outwardly. We always blame the government, the economic system, the other man. Everybody else is bad and foolish and wicked. I am the good chap, and maybe perhaps my best friend. But even he is not quite so good and sensible as I am. This is the inveterate egoism, vanity, and folly with which the human race is cursed. This ego sense which creates this obstructiveness makes for not good earth, but hard earth, stony earth, throw seed on stony earth. It won't come to fruition. The birds may pick it up. They may have a feast, but that's all. You'll get no crop out of it. Throw it on the desert, and you'll get no crop out of it. It has to be converted into good earth, fertile, friendly, living earth, into which the seed of divinity can drop, and it will certainly come to flower then. And to convert our discords in life into this fertile, yielding, inviting, pleasant, happy earth. We have to take it right into ourselves. Whatsoever we reject remains as a stone, remains as desert soil. Take it into ourselves and understand it, transform it. And then, in that action with earth, ourselves, the miracle takes place. That which is transcendence itself, embodied in us, is liberated into action, which I can't see, which you can't see. And then there is real beauty. There is real happiness. The marriage of heaven and earth has taken place. Now, let us try and see some application of this. At what level does man live? Man as a mankind, the human race. We are concerned, if we may use the symbolic terminology of yoga, we are concerned only with the three lower chakras, centers as we call them, which deal with food, sex, and commerce. Our life is confined to that. Food, sex, commerce. With a little veneer of culture. What we commonly call culture has emerged out of and by and large is confined more or less to just this, these three things. They fill our lives. And they are all self-oriented. We are conscious, therefore, entirely in terms of I, the self, the subject, and of everything else lumped as the object, the rest of the universe. I, who am less than a speck of dust, am greater than and more important than in my own consciousness than the rest of the universe. And the rest of mankind, 4,000 millions of them, more or less all of them, are conscious in the same way. And yet we will talk about the social sense and socialism and many other isms, humanism and so forth. If we want to be philosophical, we are play acting. Humanism. But I am fundamentally conscious of myself and you as something separate. How can there be humanism there? Relationship, they will say. But what sort of a relationship are they talking about and thinking about? A relationship of reciprocity, which means a conditional relationship, a relationship of mere commerce. 100 pence for a pound note. Is that relationship where life is concerned? Where the living thing is concerned? You and your wife have a baby, have a child. What is the relationship? Is it not a relationship of absoluteness? The child. Do you not give your whole love and attention, if you are a decent parent, to that child? And can you measure that whole love and that whole attention? And can you lay down any conditions on the infant? Now then, you behave thus and thus, otherwise I won't give you milk, and if necessary I'll wring your neck for you. I'm putting it in rather an absurd form. But think, is this not the sort of relationship that we have between man and man ordinarily in the world? So there can be no love under those circumstances. We are confined to food, sex, commerce. So we cannot be really social, really humane. But when we have seen into these things, and a glimmer of understanding begins to emerge out of the inner depths of awareness of the truth of things, then we are freed, at least to some extent, from this prison house of food, sex, commerce, and function at a humane level, where we can think of others, feel for others, work for others, without any sort of desire to do them good or produce a state of affairs which we think is the better one and which ought to prevail. Because any such planning and acting, and the action consequent thereon, is an expression of my own egoism, vanity, conceit, and all the rest of it. I know. Do I? I don't. And generally speaking, I do not know what is good for anybody else. I don't even know what is really good for me myself, leave alone anybody else. I will give lip service and put my faith and trust in God and say, of course, the omniscience, the omnipotence, the all-benevolent, the all-merciful and loving looks after all of us, and he's present here all the time. But my goodness, would I behave as I do behave if I really believed that and was aware that God is present here now? You see, this is the pathetic part of our experience and our suffering. We remain such ignorant, such insensitive children. And by remaining like that, we lose the innocence of childhood. The child at least is innocent. It is fresh. It is open to influence. Look how extraordinarily impressible the child is. Am I impressible anymore? Oh no, I know all about everything and you can't impress me. Whatever you say, whatever you present to me, my brain will be talking back at you, countering it, approving of it condescendingly, or disapproving of it contemptuously, and so on. Isn't that what happens in life? So you see, there can be no real humanity in our existence. But when we do wake up, do begin to see, then we begin to live at this humane level. In the Kabbalah, they embodied that in the Sephira called Tiferet. In the terms of Kundalini Yoga, Anahata, the center at the heart, as they call it. And it's a strange thing, isn't it, that when a person has really accepted another, he takes that other to his heart, not to his elbow or something. I take you, have you ever heard anybody say, I take you to my elbow? No, I take you to my heart. And unconsciously he pronounces a profound truth. So, one is now really throbbing in harmony with humanity as such, and the humaneness within us then really begins to function. Not an intellectually thought out humaneness, that this is the good thing, let's do this. This is what Christ would have liked us to do. This is what the Buddha would have wanted us to do. Read the texts, there it is in black and white. Superficial veneer. The texts come to life and mean reality for you and for me when I'm gone beyond the need of them. Then, in a miraculous way, the text has really burst out into living flame in my inner consciousness and in through my whole being. Then religious truth is real for me. Otherwise it's lip service. It's necessary to have the lip service to start with. One does start that way, because we do start in ignorance and with our incapacity and so forth. We mustn't forget that. So now, at this level of humanity, what something else also happens. The door is open for transcendence to work through the whole being and altogether transform, transmute food, sex, commerce. What we call the three higher centers come into operation. The release from domination by the three lower centers comes through the basic foundational activity of the moralities, the power of the moralities being observed, and the religious observances, as they are called. Then, helped by the discipline of the body, which means the postures, which means being perfectly sensible regarding food, drink, exercise, rest, work, entertainment is not quite the right word I want. The counterpart of work. Recreation. Thank you. Recreation and so on. And then the deeper discipline. The mindfulness which frees one from attachment on the one hand, aversion on the other hand. When I am free of attachment and aversion, then the soul is clean through the operation of the senses in purity. This is a very, very important point. This is the crux of the whole thing for human beings all over the world. Our senses operate all day long. Some people, they don't operate very much or very efficiently. But our senses operate all day long. And the sense impressions produce a psychological reaction. I like, I don't like. This is hurtful, this is pleasant. And then comes the difficulty. I like this, therefore I want to possess it, to have it. I dislike that, I want to push it away, to destroy it. Craving and violence, and therefore I never learn. But if I accept both and observe them carefully, I learn the lessons which I have to learn out of the pleasurable and the displeasurable, and both of them will inevitably and all through your life, whether you are a sinner or a saint, whether you're an enlightened one or not, pleasure and pain will always come to you, because that's how the universe is constructed. You learn your lesson from it, and you find your humanity and are poised in that humanity, which takes in everything and transforms it, because you have released the power of transcendence now to work through it all. You don't do the work. This is the important point. Transcendence does it. And this transcendence something inspires the brain, the mind, call it what you will, along certain lines, and your action changes accordingly. So, heaven is in operation here all the time, without let or hindrance by me. Now, let us look at another aspect of this marriage of heaven and earth within ourselves. We have this phrase, the marriage made in heaven. And there are several meanings to it, very valid meanings. At its simplest level, it is just this. Every one of us, whether man or woman, is dually constructed. We have masculine elements in us, feminine elements in us. One or the other predominate. Very rarely you find a person, a man or a woman, in whom the masculine and feminine sides are in an extraordinary balance. Balance in the sense of equal strength, more or less. Very rarely. Generally, one or the other predominates. Now, the task of each one of us, be he man or be she woman, is to produce the harmony of these two elements within us, the masculine and the feminine sides. When that harmony is produced within us ourselves, one extraordinary result follows. We don't turn to the world outside us to find happiness, to find fulfillment. We are self-contained in the true sense, not cut off from the world, not cut off from mankind, but self-contained. The psychophysical organism is now a true individual at the microcosmic level. The individual is a true individual. An indivisible whole. Therefore, if I realize that state, I cease to impose myself upon my environment, upon my neighbor, my wife, my children, my brothers, my sisters, my father, my mother, or anybody whatsoever, my employer or my employee or whoever it may be. I cease to impose myself. That is to say, I have changed out of the state of the obstructive stony rock into good fertile earth. That is one very important consequence of realizing the harmony and the cooperative activity of the masculine and feminine elements in our own being. When we begin to cease to be the slaves of desire, and our intellect learns what its right place is. Intellect, as I've said so often at our meetings, is the slave of desire, otherwise. This is a very important point. All those who are so indiscriminately keen upon universal education, putting knowledge into the hands of those who are not worthy of knowledge. Because knowledge is technical power. And if there is unintelligence at play, ignorance, the uncouth beast in me at play, then I shall always misuse my knowledge and produce harm and suffering for myself and for those around me. So now all these things have to be borne in mind. And this is the first and the simplest expression of this marriage. The marriage made in heaven. And it paves the way, opens up the way to a profounder marriage of heaven and earth in ourselves. I said that when one is at this humane level, the door is open for transcendence to work through one. Transcendence in operation, in activity, is itself always male-female, positive-negative. The moment there is movement, action, procedure, change, therefore beginning, growing, and transforming, which we usually call death, whenever that is the case, there is always the operation of the maleness and the femaleness. But this maleness and femaleness now is no longer a case of opposing duals. They are complementary duals. This is the harmony of love. This is the meaning of husband and wife in the transcendent sense. You will find it. You will find it in the Kabbalah. You will find it in the Old Testament, if you know where to look for it. And you will certainly find it in the Upanishads. It is there. And this, you remember I have sometimes used this phrase in past meetings. And this activity is one in which the sovereign Lord and the sovereign lady, I'm using ordinary human symbolical terms, are in timeless conjugation. That is why the activity of God, as the theists say, of Brahman, as the Hindus would say, or of the unborn, the unmade, as the Buddhists would say, that activity is an ever blissful activity in which there is perfect rest and peace also, the great paradox. All this is not out there. It is here, in you, the living you. It rests with each one of us to awake to this kind of thing, to let it emerge. There comes the point when in our everyday life there is no fall in the sense as put in Genesis, Adam and Eve fell by disobedience to transcendence. Disobedience to transcendence means, do you know what it really means? The word obey is derived from audire, meaning to hear, to listen. Obedience means to be in the state of listening. And disobedience means to fall out of the state of listening. When I get enraptured with the limited, the particular, the finite, then I am no longer in tune with the total reality. I have ceased to listen to transcendence. And this is the meaning of man's disobedience of God's command, is the word usually used, but it's a bad word. It's not a command. When the Lord God made Eden and put Adam there, he gave it unto him and advised him, eat whatsoever you like, but don't pluck the fruit of the tree, not of knowledge and evil, as we have in the Bible, but of life. The fruit of the tree of life is consciousness, complete, awakened, enlightened consciousness. That is the fruit of the tree of life. But pluck it prematurely, which means pluck it because the intellect has burst through the ramparts of heaven and seizes it for self, and then you have converted that tree of life into the tree of the duels which are in everlasting conflict, good, evil. It is easy to awake to this. It is wonderfully difficult to remain awake to it. Supposing listener and speaker are in communion, there is trust, not blind faith, not a mistaken trust, but the trust which is born of understanding, which means love is in operation. So it is easy in that circumstance to see the light. But having seen the light, it happens to me, it happens to everybody, we go out and suddenly the clouds come. But whereas in the physical world the clouds are outside my body, in this world of the mind and the heart, this world of the spirit, the clouds are generated by me. My desires, my passions make me forget. And I have ceased to be in perpetual communion with the Lord, with transcendence. And that is my fall. I fall every time then. So now, this transcendent male-female, which is everlastingly in this timeless conjugation, therefore in the state of bliss, in the state in which the fountains of love, of compassion, of truth, of beauty flow eternally. They are there within. We use these words because, at least I use these words because I have no other means of talking about the unspeakable. But it is intended to be like a little stimulus which may help you to unlock your own doors. You have to do your own unlocking. Unlock and don't let the doors get locked again. That is your responsibility. I can't do it for you. No one else can do it for you. God Almighty doesn't do it for you, because transcendence never compels. Transcendence only waits with infinite patience. And it can wait with infinite patience for the very simple reason that it is not subject to the constraints of time and mortality, but functions in eternity in everlasting bliss. And this is yours. And it doesn't come from outside, it emerges from within. Who taught these things in the past? Who are the people who speak about it now? Human beings. You, I. That is all. What is revelation? A condition of being in which the marriage of heaven and earth has come to fruition. And then that is the music of our life, of human life, the life of the happy Creator. Perhaps something like this may be the significance of the birth of Christ. 10 days more, Christmas, the symbolical day of birth of Jesus the Christ. The Anointed One, Christos, the Sinless One, whose very name means God the Savior, embodied. Jesus, Joshua, Yahshua, all three are the same name. The embodied transcendence, here, within your own being, in which this marriage can take place and survive perpetually. And this is what is born when? At the time when the sun is furthest away from us, and the days of darkness are the longest. When the seed falls into the earth, it is out of sight. Is it not? It germinates in the dark. Then it grows out into the light. And it comes to fruition and fulfillment as the days of light increase. And then when they begin to decrease, you reap the crop. Isn't that so? Isn't this extraordinarily true to our own inner life? And is it so very difficult to release that love, that understanding, and that beauty in each one of us individually, which is the only power which inevitably produces the conditions and gives the impulse for the fruition of the whole human race?